Welcome, everyone, to the Business Transportation Economic Development Committee.
That wakes you up every time.
And we're going to start off with opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 725. So we're open. Senators Rosenbaum and Winters, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. And I am State Senator Diane Rosenbaum from District 21. Here with me, Senator Jackie Winters. And we are here to talk about a little bill, Senate Bill 725, that makes two fairly small changes, but that will help a lot of people in our current challenging economy. So I am going to talk about one change in the bill, and then I'll turn it over to Senator Winters, and she will talk about the other. The first change that the bill makes deals with a situation that happens not that frequently, but when it does, it can be a real hardship, and that is that there are certain unemployed people who qualify for unemployment insurance benefits, and then it turns out, through no fault of their own, they're paid more than they're entitled to. This is only going to apply in a situation where there's some sort of mistake made, not on the part of the worker, but through the agency or some sort of administrative situation. Currently in Oregon law, there is no ability to waive the repayment of that money, even in extreme hardship cases. And so, in other words, once an error like that comes to light, the person is really on the hook to repay that money for, and not that they have to pay it immediately, but for a year after the mistake comes to light. If they qualify for benefits, it's deducted from whatever they would be entitled to. So in 36 other states, there is an ability for that repayment provision to be waived, and the language that the bill uses is in cases of equity and good conscience, which is sort of legalese for in those cases where, because of the extreme hardship or circumstances on that particular person, it makes sense to the director of the Employment Department to waive the provision for repayment. So this bill would just put us in line with those 36 other states by giving discretion to the director of the Employment Department to waive the overpayment in those situations where, through no fault of the person, they got some benefits or benefits continued when they should otherwise have been terminated. It's not a huge change, but it is something that came to my attention in the interim, and because of some cases where people were experiencing a lot of economic stress, really needed this money to just be able to put food on the table and support themselves. They were finding themselves in this unfortunate situation, and the agency's hands were tied. So that is the first change that is contained in Senate Bill 725. And then Senator Winters and I met up in the garage one day before session and found that we both had situations that could be combined into one proposal, and she's going to tell you about the other situation.
Thank you, Chair Senator Byers. My name is Jackie Winters, and I'm Senator in Senate District 10. And the second part of the bill is, and it's one that I don't think that we sitting here would have thought would happen, but as we move to electronic systems, or we move to a system where we're using the telephone more to have hearings and those kinds of vehicles, in order, a couple things, we save on personnel costs and what have you. What has occurred, if we look at the statutes, and you say if a person does not appear, we use the language appear, where appear also means telephone. Where you have a situation where the individual, for whatever reason, was not able to answer that phone, or something happened in that communication system, it's what's beyond the individual's control, this particular piece of the statute would help that individual to be able to plead their case as to what had happened in fault, rather than having to go through an out-and-out denial. because currently the way it operates, should the individual fail to appear, that's an automatic denial. And so this helps to address that situation, whether it's the employer or the employee. And it sounds like a little thing, but in this environment, it's a big thing. It's big because I don't know if any of you understand what the process is. Once a denial takes place, we then go into several levels of our system in order to get the denial overturned. This would then allow the party to seek for good cause, you know, through the current channel so that we don't have to elevate into the rest of the system.
Thank you. Questions to the senators? Senator Girard.
Yeah, the question I have has to do with kind of windfalls. It doesn't look like there's a maximum put into this bill, and it bothers me that we could waive recovery, but say that it's an amount that's kind of off the charts a little bit. And I was just wondering if you'd be open to an amendment to kind of put some maximum as to what the windfall could be.
Mr. Chair and Senator Girard, I am not quite sure how that would work, because actually right now, the way the bill is drafted, it doesn't require the state to just waive repayment of these benefits. It just gives discretion that doesn't exist right now to the Employment Department to handle these on a case-by-case basis. So it might be a question that we could discuss. I don't think the bill is going to be worked today. It might be something we could discuss with the department as to how it would work if there were a maximum amount, certainly. We aren't intending this to be something that just opens the floodgates, and I don't think it would have that effect, but we can certainly talk about it.
Okay. So we're going to recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 725, and we'll open a public hearing on Senate Bills 637 and 638. Senator Rosenbaum, Senator Boquist, and Representatives Comp and Hoyle. We may be limited on chairs.
We're never limited. We're in the chamber, Mr. Chair.
The chairs go first. We know our plate. Well, some do.
Yep. Which is, if the bill passes, you get it last, right?
So, thank you. And my understanding, Mr. Chair, is that you're taking testimony now on both bills, Senate Bill 637 and 638. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, once again, I'm Senator Dianne Rosenbaum from District 21, and very pleased to appear today with my chief co-sponsor, Senator Boquist, in support of these two bills. So these bills will help a lot of Oregonians that are really struggling, and I think we all heard the unemployment figures that came out earlier this week, that our unemployment rate has come down a little bit, and that is really good news. But the fact is it's only come down a little, and we know that we still have at least 218,000 Oregonians who are struggling, who are out of work, and who are trying to find a way to get back on their feet. And so what these two bills will do is provide an extension of unemployment benefits that are about to run out for a great many of those people. The first bill, Senate Bill 637, just continues a federally funded unemployment extension that will help about 50,000 unemployed Oregonians who will ultimately qualify for these benefits. It's a federal program that you probably are familiar with. It's called Extended Benefits, and also High Extended Benefits, that are federally funded, provide people who are out of work an additional 20 weeks after their initial 26 weeks have expired. And we have been on this program because of our high rate of unemployment now since 2008. And the program has a complicated formula, which I'm sure the department can explain way better than I can. But basically, is a two-year look back The federal regs have changed recently to allow states, because so many states like Oregon have been mired in high unemployment for longer than that period of time, to use a 3-year period instead of a 2-year period in order to qualify for this federal extension. And so the bill will simply allow us to make use of that longer period of time to qualify, and by doing that will actually help a lot of people. As I said, potentially as many as 50,000 people will qualify for this additional help. The extensions are really necessary to stave off a pretty dire situation, as you know, for many of our constituents statewide. In fact, I think the figure that I got earlier today is that if we don't do this in April, we've got about 20,000 people who will just basically be cut off of all benefits, and we really need to pass this bill as quickly as possible to access the help that they need. The amount of money that's at stake here, which will not only help people put food on the table and a roof over their heads, but flow into our local communities, is about $225 million in federally funded benefits. So it's an extremely important bill. We just really need it as we're working to get our economy back on track, as things are slowly getting better. We want people to get back to work, but we also want them to be able to survive long enough to do that. The other bill, Senate Bill 638, is a smaller bill, and this is a state-funded Oregon emergency benefits extension, similar to ones that we have approved in 2009 and again in the February session of 2010. This will allow for people who've exhausted their benefits to qualify for up to 6 weeks of Oregon emergency benefits. There are about 15,000 people who will qualify potentially to benefit under that provision. And so the two bills taken together would provide an additional up to 26 weeks of help for people that are unemployed, are looking for work to support themselves and their families while they get back on their feet. It's help that's really needed. I can hardly think of two more important bills that we could pass right now that will do more good, and just commend the bills to you, and thank you for holding the hearing and hopefully a work session today. Now I'll turn it over to my chief co-sponsor.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair, esteemed colleague, Senator Boquist, Senate District 12. I passed out to you, or had them pass out, this is the actually underutilization numbers for January. I'll explain here, and if you care to go in deep detail with the department when they get up here, but the numbers come out 1 week in the month, and then it's the next week that the state details number, and then it's kind of the following weeks when all the computations. But the sheet of paper sitting in front of you, colleagues, is exactly the same sheet that I pass out every month that it comes out, and I point out the same number I'm going to point out to you, and that's the bottom right number, and that is the U6 number. U3 is how we kind of track officially and make things look good. The U6 number is total unemployed, total underemployed, and those people who have stopped looking for benefits, and that's 20.3% in the month of January. The new number might look slightly better next week when we get it and come out. To put that in numbers, that's 440,000 individuals. One of the reasons that I signed on with the good senator, and I keep harping around this, is that we have a systemic unemployment problem that exceeds 20%, and in my line of work, when you exceed 20%, things don't work right. They start going bad on you. In this particular case for the extensions, the department can kind of address this. We really had three courses of action we could do with 637 that's here before you. We kind of do nothing, and it sort of auto-extends because the department's going forward with federal funding kind of intricacies. We can apply the bill we're doing now, which is extend, get everything in line, get it working properly the way it's supposed to, extends everything from a year. I'm going to come back to that point. Or we can simply stop the extensions. Now, you slam the brakes on right now, then you're in my world, and that's not a good place to be. The key point here is that we're going to extend this. The federal government's going to jump in here. These extensions are going to come out. My assumption is that, as we have done before, that the Senate and the House will move forward in these. But what we're doing is we're buying time. An individual that's going to be 3 years unemployed is not going to be employable. and we're buying some time. We're working on some other programs and proposals come forward. We're going to get about 6 months here, and then we need to fix the system, because the chronically unemployed that's been unemployed for 3 years, when this will come to an end in the future, won't be employable, and we're going to have a crisis. We're going to hit the wall, and so we need to look at how we're doing unemployment, how we're doing retraining, and how we're getting people back to work. And that's one of the key reasons, you know, I've signed on. We're trying to figure out what to do next. I'm meeting with the employment department, have a lot of good smart brains out there, including some of you, trying to figure out how do we get people retrained and back into the work, into the job market. With that, I'd be happy to entertain any questions. Other than that, we'll go back to work and let you have your business done. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Questions of the senators? Senator Stark.
Thank you. What's the source of the money? That's, you say it's federal funds, but is there federal? I mean, do businesses pay? This isn't a situation where businesses pay into this at the federal level, and it comes circles back. Is this
Senator Byer, Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr? If you recall, in the waning hours of the lame duck session in December, they made a special appropriations in the Congress as part of the. I don't go with the trading deal in the very end and the federal budget. Technical answer is they probably went to the Federal Reserve and the Treasury and borrowed the money. But it is federal dollars that are coming out. And it is not, as you pointed out, it's not from the UI fund necessarily at the federal level. I think there might be a little bit more technical answer that you could get from the department, but I believe it's a direct appropriations by Congress.
Yeah. So then a follow-up. So basically, this is borrowed money that we're adding to the national debt to pay for unemployment benefits for Oregonians that are unemployed.
So, if I could just take a stab at this, and I, Mr. Chair and Senator Starr, I think one important distinction between Oregon and other states, as I'm sure the members know, is that we have a system here which is an unemployment insurance system that is sustainable. Other states, unlike Oregon, and now it's the vast majority of states, have been borrowing money from the federal government just to pay what should be their own state-funded benefits. Oregon has not been doing that because we've had this system in place where our rates adjust to be adequate to pay the benefits that we owe to workers under those state benefits. So, you know, for now going on, I think, 2 years or more, states like California and increasingly the majority of states have been getting interest-free loans from the feds just to pay those benefits that were supposed to be covered by the states. We have not done that, and we won't do that. I think the department will be in a better position to talk about what portion of funding actually comes out of the taxes that employers pay into the federal government. But I think Oregon has not been adding at all to the debt. In fact, we've been part of the solution. Most states have been doing exactly what you've been describing. So, and I think it's a source of frustration to many employers and policymakers in Oregon that's the case.
Senator Byer, Senator Starr, as a follow-up, as I said, there are three courses of action, just so you know. First is do nothing and it auto-extends. We're already in that right now. Basically, it's a federal program. We're tied to the federal program. Congress passed the law, and it's here. And we're kind of, for a better word, in the courtesy mode here. We're going through the process of making sure we've connected, dotted all the T's, so on and so forth like that. It's like the rest of all the national debt. I mean, we could go into some of the floor speeches last session about where it exactly comes from, but it might not be appropriate. But it's part of the automatic system that comes down, and it's automatically connected, unlike maybe the tax code or other things. But it's here, and we're simply trying to implement it.
So then, just a follow-up. Just so I'm real clear, I understand that the Oregon benefits are self-funded. I mean, we basically pay for ourselves. But is this $225 million, that's outside of what Oregon businesses are paying. Isn't that right?
That's correct. Mr. Chairman, Senator Starr, that's outside of this. Is part of the federal year-in lame duck package passed in December.
So then, while I have my two colleagues in front of Mr. Chair, if that's okay, I'd likely vote and support this bill, but I'll tell you that I've had so many conversations with business owners in my district that are trying to hire people, and they go and put out, you know, the advertisements, people come in, they go through the rigmarole of the interview, and to the point where these individuals are offered jobs, and the jobs are then refused because, from the business owner's perspective, these individuals are happy just to survive on extended unemployment benefits as opposed to turning their lives around and coming back to work. So that's a challenge that I'm hearing from business owners in my district who are really, really frustrated with the system that we've created, that these benefits, are they going to go on forever and ever? I think that, Senator Boquist, you're absolutely correct. At some point, you've got people that have been unemployed for so long. How in the world are they going to get back into a situation where they're employable? So help me provide an answer to those business owners who are just like pulling their hair out because they can't get people to actually come to work where their jobs available.
Mr. Chair, Senator Stark, you're absolutely correct. I have a stack of them right here, just so you know. I have the same emails probably, and they're all from my district, very similar. As I mentioned, you know, option two is extend what we're doing now and buy time. Option three is stop the extensions and we hit the wall. In the option two category, which is what is really being proposed to the committee right now, is what we're saying here and what I said earlier is that we know there's a problem. We know that we have individuals that either can't find work because they're not qualified, or we have individuals, frankly, that don't want to work. And in the extension that we're talking about here, what we've got to do is go back into the unemployment system and say, all right, we need to identify workers. This is one of the things that I'm working on in my office with several of our members. And I'm not representing Senator Rosenbaum here right now because it's something we're working on in our side. Is identify those. How do we identify who needs work? How do we identify who can't work because they're not employed? And then we need a training program because many of the jobs that you're talking about, Senator, are jobs that require 2 or 3 weeks worth of training maximum, and they can get a job. And how do we make individuals like we did in the old days say, yes, I was offered a job and I didn't take it, and now your benefits are expired? And that's the system we have to fix. That's a system because of the entire society and the fact that we have 440,000 people unemployed. We can't slam on the brakes. We, as an institution, the legislature, because the executive branch hasn't come up with a plan yet, need to come up with that plan in that direction and how to work that out. And what we're doing is buying time to do it, and that's something we need to resolve in this session.
Senator, I just note that in just a few witnesses here, we're going to have the director of the department up, and that's probably a better place to address a question. Thank you, Senators.
Thank you very much.
If there are no other questions, seeing none. Representatives, welcome to the Senate side.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Beyer and committee members, for hearing Senate Bill 637 and 638. For the record, I am Representative Betty Comp, and I represent House District 22. That's Woodburn, Jervis, Brooks, and Northeast Salem. And I did give you testimony, but I'm going to go a little bit off of that because as I was listening to your thoughts, was the reminder that people have always told me that I'm a good fit for my district. And I always wonder, well, how did they know that my husband was unemployed for over 4 years? And so having lived through the experience that we're talking about today, it brings a lot of memories I'd rather not have. But as a young family, when your spouse works in construction on high-rise buildings and you're in a recession, you don't have a job. You simply don't have a job. And we were in that situation that for literally for over 4 years, there was no construction in high-rises and that sort of thing so that he was employed. And so knowing that our economy is improving and people will be hopefully working themselves back into the employment offices, that's really great news. And I can tell you personally what a few weeks makes a difference in Oregon, because we always raised our own garden so we had our own produce. Well, that makes a difference whether it's March or if it's June, how much you're going to feed your family, literally. And I have in our district, we have one of the highest unemployment numbers in the state. Marion County is higher than the rest of the state. We're above 11%. And a lot of those people are almost at the end of their benefits. We do face a choice. Do we allow them to slip off the radar, content that the economy is improving and confident that they'll find a new job, particularly if they haven't learned new skills in between? It's really hard. Or do we reach out a hand and help them along just a little bit longer? As you've heard, this Senate Bill 637 affects approximately 50,000 Oregonians who will be able to receive another 13 to 20 weeks. Again, that's kind of a harvest season time that is long in my memory. And then Senate Bill 638 provides up to 6 weeks of emergency unemployment. I can't tell you how much I support these bills. One of the reasons why I run and have the honor to serve my district is because I can and do relate with a lot of my constituents. We don't have the affluence that many districts have in this state, and jobs are hard to come by. You'll hear me talk about how we need to have 2+2 programs in school, how we need to make sure our community colleges have the funds for other programs. And this is part of it, because when you've been looking for a job and you possibly aren't confident enough to go out and seek skills and go back to college or go to college, it's tough. It's really tough for families to hit that wall that Senator Boquist was talking about. And particularly with the extension coming from the federal dollars, I think it is a wise use of those dollars to make sure that our constituents have those opportunities, and gives them a little bit more of a window of time, but it will help keep money going into our system rather than the children going hungry. And so I thank you for your time, and with that, I'm open to questions, and here's my colleague.
Representative Hoyle.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, thank you very much for listening to our testimony today. My colleagues were very eloquent, so I will keep this brief. I represent West Eugene and Junction City. I represent one half of Senator Edwards' Senate District. And we have one of the highest unemployment rates in Lane County. In our area, we've lost about over 2,500 jobs, good entry-level manufacturing, construction jobs over the past 3 years. The people in our district are not—they're not wealthy people, but they want to work. And I knocked on over 10,000 doors during my campaign, and time after time, I would come up to doors of people who were in their late 40s, in their 50s, who wanted to work, who had worked their whole life, either in the in manufacturing or in construction, who said, I just want to have a job. I want to be able to take care of my family. But nobody wants to hire me because there's somebody younger. Senator Starr, I respect what you've said, and I certainly think that we have to make sure that we're spending our dollars wisely. But as Senator Boquist said, if we put the brakes on now, that means these are dollars that will not be spent in our community, in our small businesses. And that means that these people who are living on the edge, our district has more manufactured home parks than any other district in the state. So we represent people that are just making it. You send someone into crisis, they lose their home, they have to avail themselves of services. That means we have to spend more money. So right now, Senate Bill 637 affects an estimated 50,000 Oregonians who will be eligible to receive an extra 13 to 20 weeks of benefits. And Senate Bill 638 will provide another 6 weeks of emergency unemployment benefits to claimants who've run out of all other unemployment insurance benefits over the last 3 to 4 years. I can't improve on the testimony that came before, so I will just ask you to please support both of these bills.
Thank you. Questions, representatives? Thank you very much. We'll let you go back to work.
Thank you.
All right, Director Warner and Mrs. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Lori Warner, the director of the Employment Department. With me is Susan Johnson, the acting director for the Unemployment Insurance Program for the department. We have a few slides here to set some context for the two bills that you have in front of you, 637 and 638. So I'll run through these and then see if we can address any questions that you may have at the end of this. So first slide up here, you folks have all been talking about, this is the unemployment rate that peaked in Oregon at 11.6%. That was in June. And you can tell we went from about 100,000 unemployed, which is the low point before you have the steep rise up there that was just straight up, which is, you can tell from the graph here that we hadn't seen that kind of unemployment rate climb in Oregon since back a long ways. So it was unprecedented. It was very rapid. And we have stayed up in the range of 10.5, 10.6, 10.7 since November of 2009. And we just released the unemployment rate for January, which was 10.6. So that's still where we are today. The next slide talks about the number of unemployed, which both senators and representatives were speaking to. So this is where we are at over 200,000 unemployed in Oregon. That's kind of bouncing around also between 217, 230, kind of right in those ranges. And you can see from this that we went from 100,000 unemployed straight up. That's just reflecting the rate that you saw earlier. We've had 100,000. That was in the time when we had 5% unemployment rate. We still had 100,000 unemployed folks, and those are people usually that are moving around in the system or need additional training and such to move up. The next slide is the number of people receiving UI benefits per week, and the chart shows that, you know, this is from 2007 to 2013 projected out. So on the left side is the actuals, on the right of the red line is the forecast. We had the big bump up from the recession where folks were receiving additional federal benefits and more people were collecting benefits longer period of time. The start to the drop on the right-hand side, the forecast, is really related to the federal program extensions decreasing as we move into 11 and 12, and the economy recovering. We expect less people to be drawing unemployment insurance. So both of those pieces are happening. Next slide is about the number of jobs that were lost in Oregon and then the job gains that are projected. So on the left-hand side of the vertical line, you see the recessions there from 1991 and 2001, 2003, and then the big drop in 2008-10. So the Office of Economic Analysis estimates we've lost 140,000 jobs during the Great Recession in Oregon, a decline of almost 9%. It won't be until the first quarter of 2015, so 4 years from now, to when employment returns to the pre-recession peak before the recession started in 2008. So it's a four-year climb back out to be level with where we are, where we started in 2008. We estimate we need to add 1,500 jobs per month to keep from increasing our UI rate, and if we add 3,000 per month to the current jobs, then the rate would drop to about 7% by 2014-2015. So we just released the forecast, the unemployment numbers and the employment numbers, and I don't know if you followed that this week, but we added 4,000 jobs in December and 6,000 in January, and the average between October and January has been around 5,000 per month. So that is very good, positive news, and that is the right-hand side of the vertical line where you see the little upticks. Those are the number of jobs being added per month that are projected by the forecast. So that is not a big, huge peak up like we saw the drop, but that's gradual add over time. So we do believe we're on the positive side. Let me speak to the next slide is a little bit of what the senators and representatives that were speaking to you were talking about. This, the red on this chart shows the job losses by industry category over the last 3 years. So you can see the construction, the retail trade, the professional business services, those ones on the bottom with the big bars to the left, those are all job losses over the last 3 years. And the right-hand black shows job change, both losses and gains, but there's not very many black losses. But mostly the beginning of where the jobs I was just speaking to you are beginning to be added back. So you can see that they're not necessarily added back in the same areas that they were lost from. And this is the struggle we have with people that are on unemployment insurance, is that these folks, many of them, are waiting for their same job to come back. And they're hoping that same job will come back. If you look at construction and professional business services, jobs in those industries were good-paying jobs, high-paying jobs. And what may be adding back is are jobs that are at lower pay levels and with different skill sets than what they had before. So talk a little here about exhaustion of UI benefits, which is what we're really looking at for the moment. So to your question, Senator Starr, Oregon pays from our trust fund, our solvent trust fund, the first 26 weeks of benefits. So that fund is solvent. We're not borrowing from the federal government. The business taxes in Oregon fund that fund and have continued to keep it solvent because in statute there are tax tables, and we have had a policy in this state that was set in the 1970s that ensures that you build up a fund in the good times and you draw out of it in the recessions, and then you build it back up as you start climbing out. So that's where the first 26 weeks we have had a very good, we've had a very good track record. The federally funded benefits is the next group. So there's emergency unemployment compensation. There's 53 weeks of what we call EUC. And that is the debates that you have heard go on in the national level over the last year or so, where they stopped and started these. They got approval for adding more weeks to this, and that was a big struggle at the federal level. So in December, these are the benefits, the EUC benefits are the benefits that they extended the filing dates for into 2011 so that people that qualify continue to draw those benefits. Otherwise, even if you hadn't drawn 53 weeks on December 31st of 2010, you would have had no more of these benefits available to you. So that is a big extension, a big help to states. The extended benefits, the 20 weeks that are below that, if you add the 20 and 53 and 26, you get 99 weeks. And so you read in the paper about the 99-weekers. This is the 99 weeks they're talking about. So that 20 weeks of extended benefits in December, they passed in that package that allowed the EUC filing into 2011. They also passed the ability for states to change their statutes to qualify for these benefits from a two-year look back at your unemployment rate to a three-year look back. Oregon has a two-year look back right now in statute, and so in order to get these additional 20 weeks for Oregonians, we need to change the statute to a three-year look back, which is what the bill is in front of you. That's what it does. And then on the very end of all of this benefit list, Oregon legislators and the governor approved Oregon benefits, emergency benefits, of an average of additional 10 weeks for Oregonians out of our trust fund. So that combines with the 26 weeks that we pay at the front end out of our trust fund, and we limited that to $30 million. So this is the benefit pool that people have available to them right now in Oregon. Your Senate Bill 638 is about offering Oregon emergency benefits another time for 6 weeks from April to June this year. So we currently have about 400 to 600 people a week in Oregon that are exhausting all these benefits right now. And those folks are people that we work closely with as they get close to ending their benefits. We work with them on job placement. And we work with them on next steps. Are they ready to talk about going into training or reskilling? All those kinds of conversations. We estimate there were 25,000 Oregonians who exhausted all benefits in 2010. Next slide is a summary of Senate Bill 637 and the next slide, 638, and so I'll let Susan speak to these. I think the senators and representatives in front of us did a pretty good job of talking about these. But
I agree. Chair Beyer, committee members, for the record, my name is Susan Johnson. I'm the acting administrator for the Unemployment Insurance Division. Appreciate the opportunity to share some information with you today about Senate Bill 637 and Senate Bill 638. So Senate Bill 637, as you already know, this will allow Oregon to modify how claimants qualify for the extended benefit program. And the extended benefit period is established by law. The total unemployment rate has a three-month average that must exceed 6.5%, and the total unemployment rate three-month average must exceed 110% of the same period for the previous 2 years. So, as you know, as Lori indicated a few minutes ago, the unemployment rate spiked, and then it kind of leveled off, and it's been decreasing a little bit. So the threshold requirement in statute right now means that the unemployment rate has to keep rising to remain on EB. The unemployment rate hasn't been rising. So without Senate Bill 637, which will allow us to go back and look at a three-year period, we'll trigger off this spring. So we'll be triggering off extended benefits at a time when the unemployment rate is over 10%. This past December, Congress passed legislation that temporarily allows us to look back the 3 years. So this law just goes through the end of this year. We estimate, again, 50,000 people will be eligible for $225 million, most of which will go right back into the Oregon communities. Again, if this bill doesn't pass, we'll have 20,000 Oregonians who will be without benefits the same week. In Senate Bill 638, the Oregon Emergency Benefits, and I think that the senators, everyone testified, provide a lot of information about this, so I hate to rehash it, but it provides 6 weeks of benefits. It allocates $30 million from the trust fund for the period April 17th through June, or $30 million. This period, we hope, will tide folks over until summer employment picks up. So we estimate between 17 and 20,000 individuals will benefit from Senate Bill 638.
This is just a graphic slide that shows you with and without passage of this legislation what the exhaustion rates would look like. So the red line is the forecasted number of exhaustions without the passage of 637 and 638. And what you were having referred to was in April. You can see there's a big peak of over 20,000 people that would exhaust in that 1 month, and that's because of the timing around the EUC extensions and the starting and stopping that kind of bunched some people up in the system. If you approve Senate Bill 637 and 638, you'll see the black line is the softening of the exhaustions over the next year down to a lower level, and then a peak that would occur in January, February next year when these programs at the federal level are going to end. And it is possible that there may be further conversations about these benefits at the federal level, whether there'd be another extension of filing dates. We don't know at this point. So it buys some time for the state to add jobs. I showed you that we were beginning to add 3,000 to 5,000 a month. And it provides seasonality, where in the summer folks are more likely to have employment, and helps basically, I think, the communities manage the exhaustions of people. There still are going to be people who are exhausting, as you can see from the black line, even with the passage of these two bills. Be happy to answer any questions. You do have a chart in front of you that we don't have up on the slide, but this is the trust fund schedule over the last 30 years. You should have that as a handout. It basically shows you which tax schedules we've been in over the last 30 years under Oregon's system, and we did move to tax schedule 8 in January for employers, so that's the highest tax schedule we have, so that the trust fund will rebuild its ending balances. And that historically, you can tell from the bubble charts, essentially, after you follow a recession, you usually ramp up to tax schedule 8, and you're in tax schedule 8 for 4 to 5 years before you rebuild the trust fund. And that is the projection that we expect to see for this recession, too, that employers would be in tax schedule rate for at least 3 to 5 years before the trust fund would refill. So with that, Mr. Chair, we'd be happy to take any questions you might have.
Thank you, Lori. Could you address in some way Senator Starr's question about the frustration of some of the employers in his and other districts?
Yeah, I think there were two questions. One was about who's paying for the benefits. So I hope we got that part, which is our trust fund solvent paying the first 26 weeks and then the 10 weeks for 638, and then the federal government's paying the other $225 million from the federal level. The question about the employers and the experience, you know, you have to be actively seeking work and take work if it's offered to you to continue to receive your UI benefits. So we do hear those comments from employers, and if the employers call us and let us know who those individuals were, then we follow up and stop their UI benefits after an investigation if they have refused work. So it helps us to know that that's happening, and helps us if we can deal with the employers and then stop the UI benefits. A lot of times employers don't call us, so we don't know, and we're not aware that individuals that are drawing UI have refused work. I will say that a number of, if you think about where the jobs were lost from construction and professional services and stuff, and I mentioned to you, people are hoping those jobs are going to come back. And so they may be applying for other jobs, but they're really wanting a construction job, or they're wanting a mortgage broker job, or they're wanting those kinds of jobs, and hoping eventually that those will come back, and that, you know, those are what they're trained for, that's what their skill levels are, and they're frustrated in terms of job seeking. When folks get to the end of benefits and we call them and engage them and say, what's your plan, you know, 4 weeks, 6 weeks before they're going to exhaust, we then find people are more willing to look at other alternatives, including when we show them the labor market information and their job may not be coming back that they were skilled for, more interested in looking at how to change their skill sets and gear up for jobs that will be of the future. It is a balance, and it's a struggle right now for both, I think, businesses and job seekers.
Senator Stark? So I appreciate, and I can definitely appreciate the situation that the Employment Department is faced with. I mean, with, you know, huge influx of clients, if you want, you know, individuals that are out of work. But what concerns me about your testimony is that you engage these individuals when their benefits are running out. Okay, what are you going to do? And at that point, people say, well, maybe I need some retraining. It would seem like we've got, you know, it's not an unlimited number of weeks that these folks are going to be able to draw unemployment. It seems like that those conversations maybe should be had earlier, and maybe they are, and yet the individuals just don't want to listen to it. And that, I could understand human nature in that situation, but at some level, it's hard, you know, there's a limit to the amount of resources available. The money that the federal government is spending is money that we don't have, that our children and grandchildren are going to be paying off for generations. You know, and I have taxpayers that have contacted me saying, what are you doing? You know, you're spending us into oblivion. And, you know, they see this, quite honestly, as part of that. So answer this.
Chair Byer, Senator Starr. Yes, Oregon has an aggressive system at the front end. When you file your UI claim through the call centers, then you must register in our job-seeking site, iMatch Skills, job match site, within 14 days, or your benefits are discontinued. So we then require you to actually physically come in to a WorkSource center and have an interview with our staff and have your skills assessed. And we talk with them at that point about, you know, labor market information, you're in construction, you're in mortgage brokerage, you're in these kinds of occupations that we don't see coming back, and we do engage them and talk to them about what their plans are. A lot of people, and you probably know this from your constituents, are in denial when they first lose their job about what the future looks like. And a lot of times they're not willing to have the conversation about changing skill sets. They're 50 years old, or they're 45 years old. They liked doing what they were doing, and they're angry, and there's a whole lot of other pieces that go with this. So we actively engage them. They have to continue to seek work while they draw UI benefits, and they have to assure us that they're doing that. We also have an audit function where we review a certain number of these cases after 4 to 5 weeks on benefits and check whether they're doing job search, also engage them in here's, again, a conversation about your future kind of conversation. So, but we have found that some people are quick to change and adapt and move on, and others are not so much so. And depending on where they're living, they may have limited job availability in their community anyway, and if they don't want to leave that community, it's even more of a struggle for them to find reemployment.
Just one quick follow-up, if I could. Thank you, and I appreciate you answering the questions. So on the employer side, you know, the employers that I've talked to that have contacted me who are frustrated about, you know, the situation, what kind of job does the employment department do as it relates to communicating with the employers that if they're offering jobs and to people who are unemployed and the unemployed folks are saying, thanks, but no thanks, how are you communicating with those folks about, hey, when that happens, please call us or please let us know? Is that communication occurring? I know that I can now, when those employers engage me, I can say, hey, you need to report that. But you know, on a broader scale, is there a communication going from the employment department to the employers saying, you know, we're in a situation, let's get Oregonians back to work. If you're coming up against a situation where somebody's refusing a job that they've applied for and have been accepted to, please let us know. I mean, is that communication occurring?
Yeah. Chair Breyer, Senator Starr, you know, our business reps work directly with the business community in each of these local offices, and so they have their conversations with businesses, but I think what we find is the businesses are busy, and, you know, they want to make a hire and get on and with their task in front of them, and so some of them will take the time to loop back around with us. I do believe most of them know that we want to hear, and we refer a group of candidates that we think are the best fit to them, so they may have interviewed 3 or 4 people. And so oftentimes they'll just make their hire and move on, and they don't necessarily take the time to communicate back with us. So it's not perfect, that's for sure, but we would like to hear back from more of them so that we can investigate and follow up.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Fried.
Senator Girard.
Hey, Chair Barra. I need to follow up a little bit on what Senator Starr was saying, but we represent totally different districts. I have a farm district in timber, and I noticed that you separated the data out and excluded farms in agriculture. A lot of the growers that I talked to still have trouble finding people for seasonal crops. Harvest of Christmas trees, picking peaches, picking cherries, jobs that might not be the end-all of end-all jobs, but they still pay halfway decent and would get somebody off unemployment, but they make enough on unemployment that they don't want to take these jobs. So what can you do to help me convince myself I want to vote for this, given the fact that I represent an agricultural district?
Chair Breyer and Senator Girard, agricultural labor is a whole different arena that we deal with, and farmers do struggle to get seasonal people for those jobs because of the nature of the jobs. Not everyone wants to select those jobs or be employed in those particular areas. So, you know, we work closely with the farm community about H2A folks that they want to have come to do some of the labor in agriculture. It is an area that we struggle with. So I don't have a silver bullet for that. Suggestions, we'd be happy to work with you to in your district more closely if you thought that would be helpful.
Oh, I think it would be.
It's a struggle on agricultural labor.
Well, I'm good.
Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Let's see. Now we've got Mr. Wilson.
Good Thank you. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, for the record, J.L. Wilson representing Associated Oregon Industries. We've reviewed the two bills. We do support Senate Bill 637. On its face, we support Senate Bill 638. Our support is qualified, however, and that is the issue of diversions from the unemployment trust fund. And one thing that has not been talked about the committee is just how much employers pay in unemployment taxes today. If you've got an employee who makes about $35,000, you're paying roughly $1,000 per employee in unemployment insurance taxes today. That bumped up about $100 from just last year. So employers did get a significant rate hike in the last year. We heard about it. Employers pay a premium for the system we've got. Yes, we are solvent, but that comes at a very, very high cost. It is one apparently we are willing to pay. But as it relates to Senate Bill 638, a $30 million trust fund for emergency benefits is fine. We've talked to the Employment Department. It does not seem to be an amount that will lengthen out the period of time which employers are stuck in Tax Table 8. There is some thought that we'll be there till 2016. Maybe beyond, maybe a little before. But the question to us is, when can we start reducing our rates? And I don't want to support anything that would lengthen that period of time. But Senate Bill 638 on its face, we are led to believe, will not, and so we support it in that context. But I would also say that if there is talk about diversions from the trust fund and talk about using UI funds for some other purpose other than their intended use, then we do not support that, and we would not support Senate Bill 638 as a complementary measure to that. So this conversation is one that we have side by side with potential talk of diversions, but I do want to let the committee know on its at face value we do support the measure.
Mr. Wilson, to be clear, though, the two bills in front of us do not have a diversion in them.
No. Thank you, Chair Beyer. I'm not insinuating that they do. 637 is federally paid. 638 is out of the UI trust fund, and it is consistent with the mission of the trust fund. What I am saying is if there are additional diversion conversations taking place, then 638 becomes an off-the-table issue for us because lengthening that amount of time where we're at Tax Table 8 is not in our interests.
Questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the people I have signed up. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 637 or 638? Okay, I think we're going to close. We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 637, 638, and reopen on Senate Bill 625.
725.
Excuse me, 725. And Patrick, I think, did you want to talk on this one?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Patrick Singh. I'm the legislative aide to State Representative Jean Cowan, who represents the Central Oregon Coast, House District 10. She does apologize that she cannot be here in person to testify, so she is submitting written testimony to you, which I will attempt to summarize. Senate Bill 725 not only affects claimants, but also small business owners who might be requesting parties and employers, like a constituent of ours named David Gomberg, who owns Gomberg Kites, a small business in Lincoln City that sells kites worldwide. He contacted us in December to let us know about a recent interaction he had with the Department of Employment and the Office of Administrative Hearings, in which in September of 2010, Mr. Gomberg requested a hearing on an administrative issue and noted on that that he would be traveling out of the country for business from October 11th through November 1st. Upon returning on November 2nd, he received a notice that his hearing was scheduled for that morning, that he would be, that he returned back into town at 8:15. The post office in Lincoln City does not open until 9 o'clock a.m. So obviously he missed his hearing and wrote to the administrative hearings office to request that that hearing be reopened, and was denied that appointment. because it was determined by the hearings referee that someone should have been there to open his mail. Mr. Gomberg pointed out that even if an employee had opened the mail, he would have only had 15 minutes to prepare and organize witnesses. The interesting thing that Mr. Gomberg points out to us that may seem obvious is that not every business on the coast is has a large administrative office or backup staff. He says, quote, we are not all as big as Nike or Intel with a large mailroom staff. Mr. Gomberg and his wife together are the CEO, the CFO, and also the mail clerk. I'm sure you can relate to many of those small businesses in your district. Another note of interest to point out is that Mr. Gomberg is not just one of the many frustrated business owners or constituents that we hear from occasionally, like in your offices. He and his wife are former public servants. They have worked here at the legislature. Mr. Gomberg was a committee administrator, worked in the governor's staff, and ironically, Mr. Gomberg also was a hearings referee for the Department of Motor Vehicles as well, so he fully understands the process. So Representative Cowan believes this bill, Senate Bill 725, specifically in Section 3, will alleviate some of these communication issues and also provide small businesses like Gomberg Kites the ability to fully participate in the public process without fully interrupting their daily business schedule. Thank you for the opportunity to present this testimony on behalf of Representative Cowan.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Rupp?
Yes, and I'll bring Patrick. I see where you're taking care of on Section 3. The problem I have with the bill is in Section 1, Sub 2, where there's no cap placed on what can be waived and what can't. And so I would really like to see a cap placed on that part of the bill. The rest of it, I think, is fine.
Yes, Chair Beyer and Dr. Drott, as I like to call you. I think Representative Cowan is open to any changes in the bill that can address all of our concerns. But her main issue is making sure that small businesses like Mr. Gomberg's have that opportunity, even as a requesting party, to, with good cause, of course, reschedule hearings that are requested. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything else? Thank you very much, Patrick. The department wish to testify on this one? Lori just stepped out. There we go. Welcome again.
Hello again. Chair Beyer, committee members, for the record, again, my name is Susan Johnson. I'm the acting administrative for the Oregon Employment Department's Unemployment Insurance Division. And with me here is Carla Forsyth. Carla is the chief administrative law judge for the Office of Administrative Hearings. So we're sort of doing the same thing that Jackie Winters and Senator Rosenbaum did. I will be providing information regarding sections 1 and 2 of the bill regarding the overpayment waiver issue, and then Carla will be providing information regarding sections 3 and 4. So there's been a lot of testimony already. Currently, Oregon has two statutes governing the recovery of overpaid benefits. ORS 657310, it requires cash payments or benefit offsets when the overpayment is the fault of the individual. So it's their fault, it's fraud, they made a mistake, but it was their mistake. And then ORS 657315 requires offsets from future benefits during the next 52 weeks to recover overpayments when they were not caused by the claimant. The overpayment is canceled after 52 weeks. We don't require cash payment. However, we do offset future unemployment benefits to recover this overpaid money. We don't actively collect on these accounts. And most of these non-claimant overpayments occur when an administrative decision is overturned by an administrative law judge. So, for example, someone might file a claim for unemployment and we clear their benefits, saying they had quit their job with good cause. The employer might appeal. It goes to a hearing. That decision is overturned, causing an overpayment. I think someone indicated earlier, 34 states have some sort of overpayment or waiver provision for non-claimant caused overpayments. However, most of these states don't require cash repayment and don't limit recovery to offsets, as Oregon does. And then Section 2 of the bill simply modifies ORS 657-320 to keep the overpayment cancellation statute in sync with Section 1 of the bill. And we estimate that 1,070 claimants per year will apply for this waiver request. We expect this to reduce the recovery to the trust fund by approximately $1 million per year.
Carla? Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Carla Forsyth. I'm the Chief Administrative Law Judge with the Office of Administrative Hearings, and I'd like to speak to Section 3, which Senator Winters addressed earlier on. And again, that section addresses what happens if a party doesn't appear at a hearing and then later asked to have it reopened. Under current law and rule, that reopening can happen only if the reason they didn't appear was for something that was beyond their control. That's a very high standard. Things that would clearly fall within that are unanticipated illness, heavy traffic, telephone problems, something of that nature. But again, it is a high standard. This bill would allow a hearing to be reopened if the administrative law judge finds there was good cause. And what that'll do is give the department the opportunity to initiate rulemaking, which it's my understanding they're prepared to do, to move toward a more lenient standard. So the end result would then be to make it easier for members of the public who are parties to these hearings to get their hearing reopened and have the case heard on the merits.
Is there any questions? Mm-hmm. Senator Rudd.
Well, thank you, Chair Beyer. Obviously, you've heard what I've said before about I don't mind giving you a waiver to make some decisions. I do have a problem that there's no cap to that waiver. Would you be opposed to working and trying to put some type of meaningful cap as to what you can waive and what you can't?
Chair Beyer, Senator Girard. Yes, I heard that, and one would think by now I could come up with some brilliant answer for you. but I don't have the answer to that. I certainly we're willing to work with you, and maybe that's a possibility. The Department of Labor, the U.S. Department of Labor, pretty much dictates we have limits in what we can do. Maybe it's fine, maybe it isn't, and I'm very happy to check into that and to work with you in that.
Okay. Any others? Thank you very much. David, you were just going to answer a question if there were any, right? Doesn't look like there are any here. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 625?
725.
Excuse me. I'm having a little trouble with that today. 725. Seeing none, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 725. Public hearing on Senate Bill. It's one of those days. Senate Bill 725, we do not have a fiscal on this, so we will not be moving it today. We will open a work session, public hearing on Senate Bill 534. Richard?
Senate Bill 534, we've actually already heard once. This is a second hearing. It requires that the independent appraisal of damage to a motor vehicle in cases of a dispute between an insurer and insured be conducted by a person who has been issued a vehicle appraiser certificate. We have a revenue impact, and we have there's no revenue impact and minimal expenditure impact. We also have a dash one where we have no revenue impact, but I have not yet received a fiscal on dash one.
On the dash one? So we can't move the bill today.
So we can't move the bill today unless they come in at some point and tap on council.
Alrighty. Since we have it open, is there anybody who wishes to address this? Darrell? Mr. Fuller?
Chair,
members of the committee, and Daryl Fuller, excuse me, on behalf of the Oregon Appraisers, Auto Appraisers of Oregon. I'm not sure where a fiscal on this bill or the amendments would come from, frankly. So that one catches me a little bit off guard. We support the bill with the amendments. It'll do two small things. First thing the bill does is add the word competent to the statute that deals with hiring an appraiser on a motor vehicle. Right now, you have to be licensed by the, excuse me, certified by the state, and the statute says you have to be disinterested in making an appraisal. We want to add the word competent because if you're called to appraise a specialty vehicle like a muscle car, an antique car, a dump truck, something like that, it's possible you could be certified by the state as an appraiser but not be competent to appraise that type of vehicle. So we just want to make sure that the right people get the right jobs. There's no opposition from the insurance companies for adding that language. The second part simply restates an existing statute, which is you do have to be certified by the state in order to offer an appraisal in Oregon. And that certification is done through the Oregon Department of Transportation. By referencing it here in the insurance laws, it makes it easier for people to find it and realize that they do have to get a certified appraiser. And we made sure that we didn't start an interstate fight by including language that allowed people that have a certification from the out-of-state to do appraisals here in Oregon as well. Shop this around to the insurance company. You'll notice that none of them are here in the room, which I appreciate. I offered them an opportunity to come testify on why they should want to hire incompetent, uncertified people, and none of them took the bait. So we think the bill is a good bill with the amendments, so we encourage you to pass it. It doesn't appear to have any opposition, and I said I'm a little foggy on the whole fiscal thing, so I can't help you there.
This procedure. Is there anybody else who wishes to come on down? Well, I guess there are.
Am I in the right chair? Or?
Yep, you're good.
I've got a brief...
could you identify yourself for the record, please, Bill?
Chairman Beyer, my name is Gary Vandermeer. I'm a state-certified vehicle appraiser. I've been appraising vehicles for the last 34 years. Okay. And let me preface my remarks by saying, as a Springfield constituent, I'm glad to see you're working hard. I'm here to support the passage of Senate Bill 534. I'm sorry, I'm having to go between my glasses and looking up at you, so bear with me if you would. Basically, for a number of years, there's been a question about exactly where the Oregon existing statute regarding vehicle appraisers stands in regard to it being the legislatively approved standard for appraisals. I think this bill is going to go a long way towards affirming that standard and making it an even standard across the field.
That's right.
I want to reference that there is a major problem here in this area. Last year, there was roughly 36,000 vehicles that were declared totals in the state of Oregon. 36,000 people in the state suffered a loss of their vehicle. And according to the Department of Insurance, this is one of the areas where there's the greatest number of complaints is in the settlement of those total loss vehicle settlements. And what I want to do is add some supplemental language to this bill that I think will help strengthen it. Previously, in legislation in House Bill 40-2435, the legislator established the vehicle appraisal standards for the state. And then in the last session, House Bill 2190 codified that Oregon consumers have the right to the information on the total loss process and their existing rights and options under the existing statutes and rules. This was done in what was ORS 836-080-0420. Under Exhibit 1, the state put together a information sheet that was to be given to all vehicles who suffered a total loss so that they would understand how the procedure and what their options and rights under this
new rule would be. One of the things that is not done is the identifying of the existing state statute for the standards of vehicle appraisers. There is no reference to ORS 819.480, which establishes that standard. What I would like to do would be to include that information as part of the vehicle total loss notice, which is Exhibit 1 under the previously referenced statute. This would help inform consumers that there is a established standard for appraisal when there is a vehicle total loss. Currently, many people are totally unaware, even though this mandated information was supposed to be going to the consumers. It has not been. For the most part, this information has been, in the first part of the year when this was mandated for delivery, was not given to consumers. Later on, we began to see where this information would be stuffed in with a 25 to 35 page docket at the last, so the consumers were not really exposed to this information that they had rights under the existing rules. So it would be only fair that we include that information on the applicable appraiser standard in the vehicle total loss notice, or Exhibit 1 as it's referenced in the existing statute. I wanted to ask Chair Byers a favor if I could. I just learned of this the other day, and I have not had a chance to put together all of the relevant documentation and a written summary of my remarks here. So with your permission, if I could include that additional information to the committee, I would like to do so.
You can send it to the committee staff, and they'll get it to
you. Thank you very much. I hope that the information presented here will meet your approval and that this additional language will be included in the legislation to help protect consumers. And I would be glad to respond to any questions you might have at this point.
Thank you. Is there any questions? There's none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Paul, I'm not sure I'm going to get your Paul Gustafer?
Yes, sir. I was here just if there were questions.
Excuse me?
I was here just if there were questions. If anybody had a question, I was here to answer.
Oh, okay. Good enough. Anybody got a question? Paul? Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much. That's all I have signed up for this one. Is there anybody else who wishes to testify? Again, we don't have the fiscal on the amendment, so we will not be working this further today, so we will close the... I was in public hearing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Public hearing on 534. Okay, I think that's all the ones we got. So the chair then will open a work session on Senate Bill 637. And this one will require, I believe, Richard, a referral to Ways and Means.
That is what's recommended.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 637 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 637 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Is there any opposition?
637.
637. That's what I said. There is none. Senate Bill 637 is passed to Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation with a unanimous vote. We'll close on 637. We'll open on Senate Bill 638. And again, I believe this needs to go to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 638 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 638 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Senator Girard.
Thank you, Chair Barr. With your indulgence, I'm going to support this, but the answer I got about employment for farm work is just not satisfactory. And I really feel very strongly that if someone's unemployed and someone offers them a job picking cherries or picking peaches, harvesting Christmas trees, that should be, I know that might not be their end-all of end-all jobs, but I really, we need to get employment for the farm community. So I'm going to support this. It's probably not a good vote for my district, but I do feel very passionate that in this downturn, especially in the construction trades, we do need to do this.
Thank you, Senator. Perhaps you can have some additional discussion with the director on this. Maybe there's an answer in there somewhere. Further discussion? Seeing none, is there any opposition? Seeing none, Senate Bill 638 is passed to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation with unanimous vote. We'll close Senate Bill 638. We'll open on Senate Bill 6. Richard?
Thank you, Chair. We already had a public hearing on this. Senate Bill 6 authorizes Secretary of State to establish, maintain, enhance, and expand a central business registry, including providing for more functions over the Internet and integrating functions with local government and public bodies. There's no revenue impact, but there is a fiscal impact and a request to refer this to Ways and Means.
Okay, is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 6 to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Senate Bill Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 6 to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing no discussion, is there any opposition?
Senate Bill Atkinson.
I did say Atkinson, didn't I?
Said Senate Bill Atkinson. I like it.
Well, I'm hitting on all cylinders today. Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 6.
That's good.
Anyway, is there any opposition to this bill before I screw it up more? There is none. Senate Bill 6 is moved to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation with unanimous vote. We'll close on Senate Bill 6. We'll open on Senate Bill 179. Richard. You can give him a chance.
Senate Bill 179, we've already heard. It authorizes the Travel Information Council to issue citations for violation of health and safety rules at roadside rest areas managed by the council. We have no revenue impact and minimal expenditure impact.
As I recall, we had a question on where the fine monies went. Do we have an answer to that? Apparently, Mr. Campbell would like to address it. Mr. Campbell, do you have an answer to that?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Campbell here on behalf of the Travel Information Council, and I do have an answer to the question that was posed before. Any fines that are assessed as a result of a citation go to the circuit court in the area where it was given, wherever that rest stop is. There are two assessments that occur. One is the central assessment. That amount goes to the general fund, and then there's a portion that's called the county assessment. A small portion of the amount goes to the county, ostensibly for covering the costs of providing court services. None of the money goes back to either the agency that created the rule or the Travel Information Council. It goes to general fund.
So no encouragement to bounty hunt?
No. Sir.
Does that answer your question? Okay. No.
Senate Bill Beyer, I would move Senate Bill 179 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
You're really working on it today, aren't you? Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 179 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, is there any opposition? Seeing none, Senate Bill 179 passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And we are closed on Senate Bill 179, and I need carriers. I will carry, which is one that's federal, I always forget. The chair will carry Senate Bill 637. Is there any volunteers on
638? Why don't you ask
Rosenbaum or Boquist? Oh, Boquist. The chair will discuss this with Senator Boquist. Put me on until I have a discussion with him. Make sure. Senate Bill 6. Senator Edwards, would you carry Senate Bill 6? That's two ways and means. We don't have to worry. Senate Bill 179. Volunteer. Senator Atkinson, would you like to carry 179?
No.
Of course he would.
No, I wouldn't.
Will you carry Senate Bill 179?
What, if you're going to look over your glasses at me, I guess I'm going to have to.
Senator Atkinson will carry. Is there any other business before the committee? There is none. Thank you all. We are adjourned.